This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm talking with Greg Wolfond.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Greg, you're the CEO of SecureKey. You've just made a big announcement with IBM around blockchain and where you see it impacting consumers in particular, not a shipping or generic finance type solution, which is what most of blockchain announcements have been lately. Can you give us some insight into what it is you're looking to do and how you see it impacting consumers in particular?
We think it starts with consumers, but we think at the end of the day, we're all people. Proving who you are and having strong identity in all of those applications, whether I'm shipping or whether I'm a doctor proving who I am to access medical records, all that stuff foundationally is I need to know that it's Greg, or I need to know that it's Dr. Greg, or I need to know who it is accessing a service. This stuff historically has been pretty hard, right? It started in the beginning days of being up to the consumer to prove who they are. I show up at a bank to create an account. I have to show my driver's license. I have to show a bill. I have to show all of that, which is too complicated and too slow a process. And it certainly has friction and it's slow. It takes 30 minutes to open a bank account very often in person. But it also leads to fraud because I can get fake documents and prove who I am in different ways. So we started in Canada looking at this a long time ago. We partnered with the banks. We created a login service called Concierge, where you could show up at government, in any of 80 different departments, at tax, at unemployment, at pension, and log in with your bank. Just use a bank authentication method. It's all based on SAML protocols. And we were really strict about a blinding principle, that it was really important that the bank didn't know where I was going, which department I'm logging into, and the government didn't know what bank I was choosing. But that was more about off. And we wrestled for a long time of how do we do the identity bit. I get confused because when I tell my wife digital identity, she rolls her eyes. So is it really, what is digital identity? We try and say we're trying to create frictionless URU. How do I show up at a call center of a bank or government and prove who I am in a couple seconds instead of being asked questions that I don't know the answers to? Or how do I show up in person and prove who I am and give the institution higher confidence? Or how do I show up online and open a bank account in seconds where my privacy is protected because the parties who are engaging in this ecosystem is protected, and I get more stuff done in less time as a consumer? And once I can do that as a consumer, we think it starts to apply to businesses, it applies to shipping, it applies to buying someone else's used car where I may want to prove who I am, buy the title, pay for the good, and just make all of these experiences more frictionless.
But how do you start that process? If we go back 20 years, 30 years, and talk about Class 4 digital IDs, you basically turned up at a government office and accepted you were going to be stripped naked, measured, marked up, fingerprinted, footprinted. It was a very invasive, very intrusive, very complicated process. How do you make this so frictionless where it's simple for people to come in to set up their initial identity and then begin to use that to establish other parts of their lifestyle?
Yeah, so that's a great delineation, right? Like, we don't create ID, and banks don't create identity, and telcos don't create identity. Foundational identity is done with government. You have a birth certificate, you have a certificate of record, you have things like driver's license, which, if done right, are really identity documents. But what we have to do is validate. What we do is more of an identity validation service. Once Greg exists, I need to know this is actually Greg Wolfond, who lives at this address, who's showing up for service. So there's two parts to that. One of them is the identity validation part. How do I really know it's Greg, and how do I get a score on that? And one of them is the auth part. How do I, Greg, authenticate well enough that someone else can't authenticate as being Greg and get through the screen to do me? And you have to do both of those in parallel. If you do one without the other, it doesn't really work. In Canada, as an example, we're already on Hyperledger. We built on Point 6. We connected to six of the banks that had invested in us, and we're able to load attributes or enable sharing of attributes like my name, my address, my date of birth. We're able to load telco attributes, like the telco knows this is me on this device, the SIM is in the device, location of device, parts like that. And we're able to load things like driver's license. Can I load that the state actually knows it's me by checking the face on my driver's license and move there? When you combine those things, because the bank is really good at the what I know, the password piece, and a lot of the smarts around, I'm logging in at 9 o'clock from Toronto, and then I'm logging from New York at 10 o'clock. Oops, that can't happen. So they really do that well to protect money. But if you take that what I know and the smarts around it and all the security they have and add it to what telcos know, here's the device, the SIM is in the device right now when Greg's doing a transaction, you can see it starts to get stronger. And then if you add the state government that really knows, hey, this is a document I issued to the real Greg Wolfond and his face matches, you could start seeing, wow, the combination of these is really strong from an authentication standpoint, but also from an ID validation standpoint. Because the bank checks me, and because I log in right now on the mobile device that's here, they can say, yes, this is Greg. And the telco can say, yes, this is Greg who has the device, and the device is here right now. What we try to do with the service we're launching is say every party who participates should be able to monetize the capabilities they're bringing to bear. So a bank is willing to share or help me share on my behalf that I'm Greg Wolfond, I live at this address, here's my date of birth. And a telco is willing to share, yes, we also know this is Greg Wolfond and the SIM is in device. And a state government is willing to share, yes, we know it's Greg. If I show up to get service at a bank to open a bank account or at a telco to open a new account, and what they want to know is give me proofs. well, I logged into this other bank right now, and they're sharing its Greg Wolf fund, and the telco is validating, and the province is validating. Different parties will want different proofs at different times. Landlords pay real estate agents 1 month's rent when someone comes in to say, okay, now vet them. Go check their income, go check the background check, go do all this stuff. They pay them a lot of money. That's, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 often in rent. But what if we could show up and in a click, are you willing to share your name and who you are from a tier one bank, your credit score is over 700 from a credit agency, and a background check? The friction that takes out to the huge percentage of the population that moves every year is huge. And if you could then say, hey, are you willing to share your data to create an internet account? Yes. Hey, do you want rental insurance? You share here? Yes. You can see this work that there's hours and hours for citizens to do can be simplified. But to do that well, and this is the biggest articulation of why we went to Hyperledger in the first place, is you really need to make sure that that whole network is what we call triple blind. So triple blind is, I guess, a more difficult concept to explain. The best way to explain single blind is when you take your driver's license and you show up at a bar, and then you go to a liquor store, and then maybe another bar, and maybe on occasion another liquor store. What's important is the state cannot track where you are. The relying party there trusts the claim that you're you because they look at the document, but there's no way they can track you from place to place. So in a system that we built, we said that characteristic has to exist in the digital world. It wouldn't normally. In the old days where we had PKI, I would encrypt the data from one point to another point, and the first point would know about the second point because we're having an exchange. There shouldn't be a way that the giver of the claim knows where I'm using my claim. The second part is the receiver shouldn't necessarily know who is the giver of the claim. So in the case of the Canadian government, they wanted specifically not to know what bank I'm logging in with. I don't want to share what bank I bank with the tax authority, and I don't want to share my telephone number necessarily with this party. The receiver shouldn't necessarily know and can be very often is blinded to who is providing the claim. I need to know it's a tier one bank. I need to know a telco has also said. I need to know the state government has also said yes, but I don't necessarily need to know their side. And the most important part in what we do and what blockchain comes is that the network in the middle should see nothing. A lot of the requirements there come out of the new NIST requirements and why we received a big grant from Homeland Security is that in the case of what we're building here is we don't want a broker in the middle. Historical models put a broker in the middle. It's based on SAML or OpenID. All the data goes to that server. And then you can, if you're not behaving properly, you could be honest but curious. You have a central point of failure. If baby monitors want to take the service down, you have honeypots of data because in some markets, for example, they get Experian or others to load all the data about me and then use their password to log in. Well, those are targets. Bad people aren't going to come through the firewall. They're going to play by rules we don't play with. We talked about airline security a few minutes ago. Think about if I've got 20% of a population of the country sitting in a database somewhere and I know your driver's license and your passport and everything about you, is it worth organized crime's time to take someone you love and say, this person's not coming home unless I have the keys to the kingdom now? Because there's none of us who wouldn't give the keys to the kingdom in that scenario. At which point, yeah, maybe you only compromise 20% of the population, but identity data is more valuable than payment.
There's another side of this, and that is how do you avoid identity theft? The broker might have all that in the old model, but actually today we're seeing criminal gangs going out, they're taking data from multiple breaches. They are building cloud-based databases to pull that data together to mine, to find all those intrinsic pieces, those unique elements. So how do we prevent somebody walking along and saying, oh yes, I know which bank account he has, I know what this is, I know what that is, by having that level of early warning so that even though they might know my national insurance number or they might know where I bank, they can't actually impersonate me in this system.
That's a great point. This is exactly the point. You know, I have a friend who ran one of the national banks, and he said to me, if we have a customer on the phone and they can't answer our security questions, it's probably our customer. Because the bad guy has that database, can answer all the things. What was my car? What was my mother's maiden name? They've got all that stuff, and they could be me. This is the problem that we're trying to solve. In order, in our system, to prove who I am, you talk about, you know, getting more secure, in order to share my data to open a new bank account, I have to right now know the login to my bank. And I have to possess the device that the telco and the bank both know this is my mobile phone with this SIM in the device. And if someone doesn't know my password and have my device, they can get through. If I want to make it more secure and I'm opening a new bank account, hey, can I turn on the camera and validate your face against the province? Can I ask you other questions that come from Equifax or TransUnion or a credit thing? We have all kinds of sources we can go against. And depending on the strength that a relying party wants, we can raise the bar and raise the bar to really make sure the fraudster doesn't get through. But at a bare minimum, we've got to get the auth up to level 3 in a usable way and the validation up to a level 3. And the both of those combined, really starts to mitigate fraud, because someone may be able to phish, maybe not me, but some people, for their bank password. But to get my bank password and to have my mobile device and have me not report to my bank that my bank password's taken, or to my mobile company that my SIM has been validated, it's a higher bar. I'm not saying it's impossible, but we've got to keep raising the bar, because the bad guys are clearly, as you talk about, after identity data, and they understand the value of identity data.
One of the interesting use cases that you put forward was healthcare. And healthcare is quite a challenging one at the moment. For example, if you go into a hospital, particularly in the United States, everything's billable. But that billing team see my medical procedures because they see my entire record. To me, I see here where I would want to completely decompose this data. I don't mind my surgeon seeing the MRI for the body part he's about to operate on. I don't mind the psych unit seeing my latest evaluation because I'm having a hard time. The billing department, they can just see the fact that they've got to charge me something. How do you decompose that and make that easy for somebody to start to get that granularity?
The whole intent of how we build this is exactly to do that. In some of the provinces in Canada, we're already becoming the de facto way you're going to log in to see your health records. Because I shouldn't have a new password every time I log in. What if I can just show up at my health provider, enter my mobile number, or take a picture of a QR, and it basically says, hey, do you want to log in to see your records? And I authenticate with my bank, and I'm logged in, same as we do for the national government. That first step of being able to log in is a huge one, because the problem for health and things like that is if they create a user ID and password, I'm never going to remember it 9 months from now when I come back to get something in health. The second part is, who do I consent to share my data with? So this is the whole model of the verified platform that we have. Every time I'm sharing data, we make sure the requester is authorized to be able to ask the question. We don't want to have over-asking, and we don't want to have over-answering questions either. So are you willing to share this data with this party for this purpose? So there's apps in Canada, for example. We have, you know, unfortunately in Canada, we have 3 million people with diabetes. In the U.S., probably closer to 30 million people. But researchers want to know, can I get that data? Can I get your data on an anonymized basis so I can watch what you're eating, watch what you do, and start having better cures by getting data? The last trial they ran at UHN, that's our biggest hospital group, cost $3 million and enrolled 300 people. The process of consent and do you agree to share this data on an anonymized basis for this purpose is too hard.
But how do you prove that anonymized basis? If we look at some of the surveys we've had and some of the university reports, we're down to maybe 3 or 4 pieces of data that are enough to identify an individual, particularly around a mobile phone type transaction. In a hospital environment, it's probably less than that.
So there's huge parts to move in the hospital world to make this really work. It goes all the way right down to the machine where when they take the x-ray, it prints your name and everything on the x-ray. So we have other problems to solve in identity and really keeping up with HIPAA and the legislation. We're sharing this to get read somewhere where I don't want to say my name, but the machines are printing my name on the x-ray. So there's huge problems in healthcare to get that stuff through. But the general point of consent, do I want to share my data with this party for this purpose? And then our goal working with IBM is just enable those tools out there. We're not going to build the applications. But someone's going to build a great application for sharing medical records. And someone's going to build a great application for nurse practitioners going to my mother's home to look after her so I know that the nurse is actually there at that time and can help my mother. And there has to be a better way to share my data when I show up at a doctor, because the problem now is in Canada, it's in 4 different places. How do we start to pull it together into one place so that the user can actually access it in these places and share it over here? Because what happens very often is someone shows up at critical care and the doctor's working on them needs the data, but it's not in one place. It's in several places. So how do you then go solve that? There are times when I need to consent to release it. And in healthcare, there's times when the practitioner just has to be able to see it, and I'm not able to release it. So we have to have rules around consent and release and access.
You talked early on about trying to make this frictionless, and frictionless from the point of the consumer of the data. But clearly at the back end, data has to be prepared. There has to be a way that we do the granularity of what we're going to allow people to accept and not accept. Part of the issue becomes cost. If we look at the challenge for two-factor authentication for companies, the reason we don't have it widely used is it's complicated for them to put in. Particularly in the small to mid-sized enterprise, they don't have the skills. They don't know how to integrate this because it's all about integration. It's not about configuration. How do you take that step forward and make that frictionless on both sides here, which lowers cost, it improves the likelihood of adoption?
It has to be consumables as a service. So it's APIs open to app developers that they can use the strength of bank auth, that they can use the device auth capabilities, and it's all together as a package, and then people can consume it. What's happening in Canada is telcos, banks, governments all cooperating together because they realize this lowers the cost for everyone. It makes it less expensive to do KYC and AML. It makes it less expensive to open a bank account. It makes it less expensive to call the call center in government, and it all requires that level of auth, right? If we don't get to that level and make it simple, so it's as simple as you see our user experience as I show up at a site, I take a picture of a QR, enter my mobile number, I click a link inside. Hey, do you want to open a new account at this telco? Click the link, authenticate with my bank. It's authenticating not only their auth, but also device auth and location and everything else. Are you willing to share your name and address and your credit score with this provider? Yes. done. So it has to be that straightforward. We are doing huge usability on how do you limit the screens and make it quicker and quicker for people to get this done. Because if you don't, to your point 100%, if you don't make this easy, it won't get adopted. If you go to DNA and insert a DNA sample here, yeah, it's going to be super secure, but no one will adopt it at all.
You've been working with the Department of Homeland Security, as you were saying earlier. One of the challenges for organizations like that is they want to be able to track. They want to be able to find all those touch points, which seems very counter to your position at the moment, that the idea is that people shouldn't be able to track you. They shouldn't be able to find all those pieces of data. How do you square that circle? Because that's not a simple thing to square off. You've got a legal case, a perfectly valid legal case, either law enforcement or intelligence agencies in certain circumstances, who need to be able to track bad guys. On the other hand, the bad guys want to rely on the same privacy that everybody else gets, and they don't want to be tracked. Is there a conflict here, or is it something that is solvable?
It's a great point. It's exactly what we had to architect to solve, because you will have what we call break the glass scenarios where there's a criminal activity or something has happened in network. We have to go and look at that, and we need consensus from multiple parties to go get the data. We needed it so one node, a bank or other, can't just go look in and figure out where did Greg go or mine the data out of nodes. But we needed to make sure that we had that case where it was law enforcement or was an identity compromise, that we could break the glass and go see it. And so we had to provide both sets of capabilities in the system, because if you don't have the other, if you put your hand on your heart and say privacy at all things, there are legitimate cases where someone has taken over my identity. They did hit me over the head, do a liveness test on my face even though I was unconscious, have my phone, somehow knew how to log into my bank, I don't know, raised the bar, and then me, and then I've got to go get it back. There is a legitimate break the glass scenario, so we have this, a lot of work gone into break the glass and how and who would be able to do it and what's the process to go through. But it has to be in the system in a way that's not abusable.
In your press release, you talked about the opportunity for banks being able to re-intermediate themselves. Early on, we were talking about the bank being willing to provide this data, the telco being willing to provide data, other parties in this. We know with banking in particular that anything a bank touches, they want payment for. Do you see there being the potential here for some parties to say, actually, yes, we think we're more trusted, something coming from us will carry more weight because we're tier one versus tier three, and therefore we'll charge you a small sum? Has that conversation been had? Do you see that playing out?
For the most part now, we're seeing the participants who come in, they want to be able to provide data and utilize their best capabilities and monetize those to some extent. But they're, as much as organizations, consumers of data. I want to open a new bank account, so if I can get more trust from the telco and more trust from provincial governments, so I know the license is real and everything, and that kind of thing, I'm willing to pay on that side. Remarkably for us, the banks see this as an ecosystem, that if the others don't participate, it will not work, so we better make sure that it works for everyone coming in. Now, the banks have things that they want to add. As an example, if I'm in your home and I want to buy your couch on eBay or something like that, wouldn't it be great if I could just authenticate with my bank and then say to you, hey, would you like to buy that using your savings account or on your Visa card or using your line of credit, is whatever. And we have to let them differentiate in that. What you care about when you're selling your couch or you use motorcycle or something else is that you get a message to say, okay, you've been paid and it's in your bank account now. The bank normally wouldn't be present for that transaction. They wouldn't be present when I'm renting a new apartment to pay first and last month's rent and connect payment. They wouldn't be present when I'm getting tenant's insurance. But now all of a sudden with this, as you get into identity, they are kind of present. They're present when I'm renewing my driver's license and it's $81 to pay the fee. So we see ID and B and payment going really closely together and opportunities to re-intermediate the bank there. We're not going to be the payment rails. Visa has rails, debit cards have rails, others have rails. But enabling that payment and initiating that payment, we're seeing great use case for that. So that's a service that the bank does offer and sees value.
It also has the potential for banks to be able to fight back against all the new payment providers in the market. The reason why they've lost a lot of payment transaction is because it's not been easy for the consumer to walk into somebody's house and buy that couch. I can transfer with PayPal, trying to do it with your bank and set up a payment immediately. They have small limits. They make it very hard to do.
Yeah, they have small limits. It takes 3 days to get the money out of that account into my bank account. There's all kinds of barriers to that. It's a very high fee for that transaction. I think there's room to innovate in that space and make it better for all the parties concerned. We'll see where that evolves.
Greg, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.